This is Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. I'm Kevin Kelly, and on the show today we have Sam and Joan McCready, who are director and star, so to speak, respectively, in A Time to Speak, which is an adaptation of a memoir of that name by Helen Lewis, who was a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps and went on to be a rather well-known dancer, choreographer in Ireland, and started the Belfast Modern Dance Group. And we have Joan and Sam with us on the show today. Their performance is being given tonight and tomorrow night at the Krannert Center in Urbana, and Sam is giving a MillerCom lecture sort of surrounding that, leading up to that, at 4 o'clock this afternoon. We'll hear more about it and some of the music involved in the production on Live and Local. In the second portion of the show, it's the Arcadia Chamber Players, three of their members. They're giving their spring, or rather their fall concert this Saturday evening in Urbana, and we'll be hearing a live sample of that in our studio. The opening of the second movement of the Dvorak Cello Concerto with Jacqueline Dupré. There's the soloist and Daniel Barenboim conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We're playing that music because it figures quite prominently in the adaptation by Sam McCready called A Time to Speak, from the memoir of that name by Helen Lewis. And this is a solo performance, in fact, a one-woman show, so to speak, by Joan McCready. But Sam is the director, and various other folks prominently involved in this, including a choreography by Philip Johnston and Kirsty Simpson. Both are on the faculty of the University of Illinois Dance Department. Sound by Richard McCready, and then there's video projections as well, and quite a number of dancers involved. And we'll ask in a little bit maybe how that all happens in a one-woman show. But we have both Sam and Joan with us on the program today, and those performances are tonight and tomorrow at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana at 7:30. And Sam is giving a MillerCom lecture at 4 o'clock this afternoon leading up to that. Thank you both very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So either of you can answer this question, however you want decide you want to do it, but who was Helen Lewis, and I guess this one for Sam, what interested you in adapting her memoir for the stage?
Helen Lewis was a dear friend of ours. We met her in Belfast in Northern Ireland, where she came to live after the war. Helen had lived in Prague and had studied there to be a dancer, and during the Nazi occupation was deported to Terezin, or Theresienstadt, as it's possibly better known to most people. She spent 2.5 years in Terezin before being deported to Auschwitz and finally to Stutthof labor camp near the Baltic Sea. Helen survived those camps in miraculous ways, and that is why we tell her story in A Time to Speak, which was the memoir which she wrote just a few years ago.
So, Sam, is it just the fact that she was a friend that made you want to adapt this, or more than that?
Yes, I mean, that's a principal reason. We were part of a theatre company called the Lyric Theatre, and Helen was the choreographer there, and we've really formed a very, very close relationship with her, not only a working relationship but a personal relationship. And initially Helen never talked about the Holocaust. We didn't know at all. This woman had a number written on her arm, and we never asked questions.
So you, when you say you didn't know, you didn't know that she had been in the camps?
We didn't know. Mm. She never said anything about it, and we didn't realize it. But as we got to know her more and more, and she felt more comfortable with the community and with ourselves, she began talking and sharing that story with us. Eventually, she started writing. She had two sons and grandchildren. And one of her sons said, "Mom, you really have to write your stories down for the children." And so she did. She began writing the stories for them. And they, but the stories are so powerful, and yet are written in such a pure way, a way that has that doesn't have an agenda, or is not attempting to engage you and saying, "Isn't this appalling? Isn't this dreadful?" She tells the story very, very simply, and so that was published. But I felt that getting to know Helen very, very well, and I felt that she was so rooted in the theatre that that was a form in which her story should be told. She had said at one stage that Joan was the only person that she would actually allow to read her story aloud on BBC Radio. And then at another stage, she also said that Joan was the person whom she would like to perform this if it was ever adapted for the stage. And so I really took that on, that to place the work on the stage. But as well, this element of dance is very, very important to her story. And, you know, we have to see dance. We have to be there while it's happening. And so that's another reason why I felt the story must be taken off the page and presented for an audience so that I could incorporate dance into the work. Now, it would be very difficult to bring a troupe of dancers with us as we tour around the country, and we tour quite a lot in Europe and in Ireland and the UK. But one of Helen's dancers is Philip Johnson, and Philip had trained with Helen, and so it made sense that I use material that Philip had done here with his students at the University of Illinois on this campus, and incorporate some of those sequences into this work. And that's exactly why, that's exactly how dance is incorporated, and how we have a list of dancers who are part of a one-woman show. There was one very, very important dance that I needed someone special for, and I asked Philip about this, and he said Kirsty Simpson was the woman to do this, and she dances to the Dvorak that we have just been listening to,
the cello concerto,
and because the night that Helen was due to leave, she and her husband were due to leave Prague and to go to Terezin, she sat with a close friend and they put on the Dvorak, and she says, "You know, Dvorak, we've no more words, we've nothing to say, but the Dvorak will say it for us." And so at key moments in the performance, at the moment when she discovers or tells us that her husband has actually died in the camps, then I use again the Dvorak, but danced by Kirsty Simpson, and it's a dance of grief, of pain, of longing, and so in that way dance is incorporated into the performance, that, and there are other sequences of dance as well.
I don't think Sam has told you yet that the dance is on video. The dancers are not actually live there with us on the stage. That's why it's still a one-woman show.
There are other elements of music, Sam, that you're involving in your talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock, which you had told me was sort of not necessarily introducing this performance, but certainly supporting this performance.
Yes, it is supporting the performance. I'm talking under the heading Art Within Walls, and I'm looking at art in the Terezin Ghetto. A remarkable amount of art was produced there, painting, dance, playwriting, but principally music. And there were a number of Czech composers who were in Terezin, and we have a Viktor Ullmann is possibly the best known and the finest of those composers. There is also Pavel Haas, Hans Krasser, who wrote the children's opera Brundibar, which I understand was performed here last year by a local children's group, and also Gideon Klein. Gideon Klein was a very young man when he entered Terezin, and he's important to us because Helen Lewis worked with Gideon Klein on a play called The White Shadow. It was again a solo performance, but the person was played by two women, one a dancer and one an actress, and Gideon Klein composed the music for that play, and Helen danced to his music. Now, sadly, all of these composers were sent to Auschwitz, and all of them died. And the Krasser, Ullmann, Pavel Haas are all in their mid-40s. Gideon Klein is 26. When he dies at the end of the war. And what is so sad about this is that a whole generation of Czech composers has been lost to us. Klein, from the work that we know of his that has existed, some of it written in his late teens, certainly in his early 20s, written in the camps as well, we know from that Klein had the potential to be in the line of Smetana, Dvorak, Janáček, Martinů, and Klein and Ullmann. But unfortunately, we really only know those composers today, the Ullmann, the Klein, and Haas and Krasser. Principally, we know them because of Terezin, rather than recognizing them as major composers in their own right. And I think that's a tragedy, another one of the many tragedies that occurred because of the Holocaust and the destruction of so many, many, many people.
You brought along some of these other pieces, at least portions of them. We have something of, what was Ullmann's first name again?
Viktor.
Viktor Ullmann. And we have that queued up. What is this piece? Do you recall?
I really can't recall at this stage. I'm sorry. I don't have that information with me. I recorded this a while ago for it's a ser- and I chose it for the lecture. But I at this moment just can't remember.
Well, actually, I don't think knowing the name is necessary as we listen to it. I mean, the emotional quality is immediately apparent. Thank you. Music of Victor Ullmann here on Live and Local. It will figure in Sam McCready's Millercom lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's entitled Art Within Walls, Artists and Musicians of Terezin, 1941 to 1945. And that is going to be in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus in Urbana on South Gregory Drive. Just across the street from there tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30, you can see his wife involved in Sam's adaptation of A Time to Speak, the memoir by Helen Lewis that we've been talking about here, along with choreography by Philip Johnston and Kirsty Simpson, which is going to be projected behind Joan as she gives this one-woman performance. And I guess my question for you, Joan, is how in essentially recreating aspects of the life of Helen Lewis. I haven't seen this show, so I'm only imagining what must go on, and I haven't read the memoir. How do you keep the dramatic emotional distance that you, I would think you would have to, in order to pull off the performance?
It is certainly a very emotional performance, because one has to be involved, one has to get involved deeply with the material. Helen herself was full of life, full of joy, full of laughter. The last thing you would have imagined was that she had been through the horrors of the Holocaust, the horrors that she recounts. Never in her life did we ever hear her speak with any kind of bitterness, rancor, anger about what she had been through. And yet, as I was studying the role, and of course knowing Helen very, very intimately, as we did over a great number of years, she died just on New Year's Eve last year at the age of 93. So we'd known her for many, many years and worked with her. But knowing her so closely and having to come to terms with what she put in her book, as we say, very simply, for her grandchildren, I was suddenly freed up by a remark by the Irish novelist Jennifer Johnson, who was also a friend of Helen's, who wrote the foreword to her memoir, when Jennifer says that it is told with a controlled anger. And suddenly I said, yes, it is down there underneath. So although she finds a lot of joy too, it's not all a downer, there's no way it is, but to tell these horrors and to recount them, there is anger there. So the emotional range is a huge arc during this piece.
How do you think she managed to live her life without that rancor?
She was full of love. She found in her dance her great spirit. I say in her words, the spirit of dance came back. I talk about the overwhelming power of dance that she felt. And because she was able in her life, once she came back, once she came to live in Northern Ireland and married a man who had been a childhood sweetheart, and had actually they had parted because he felt that he was being replaced by dance in her life as she grew up into her teenage years and on into her dance education years. Her life became involved in dance again once she got to Belfast, and that was so important to her. She formed the Belfast Modern Dance Company, which was the first modern dance company in Ireland. And that is still going on to this day. And Philip, indeed, was Philip Johnston, and we spoke of earlier, was one of her dancers. I danced with her myself for a time when I was much younger. Mm. And so that the radiance of her life, the fulfillment of her life, I think, was what saved her from that bitterness and rancor. She was a remarkable woman.
Is there, I mean, I didn't ask you this ahead of time, but it just occurred to me now, is there a short passage from the show that you might be able to speak for us that would reflect that aspect of her?
There's no reason I can give, no logical reason why I survived the Holocaust. It has nothing to do with any qualities, physical or otherwise, that I possessed. For millions and millions of others who were stronger, wiser, better equipped, more courageous than I ever was, didn't survive. We were all destined for the gas chambers. When I look back over the events of those years, I can make little sense of it. Except perhaps I was a dancer.
And as Sam said earlier, it's sort of amazing that not only was she able to come out with that kind of spirit, but also all this other music was created, some of it very sad, some of it not so. And you brought along also, Sam, music that you're going to use in the Millercom lecture that you said was Hans Krause of Brundibar. Brundibar, yeah. Which is one of those.
Oh, absolutely.
With all the a children's opera.
It's full of joy and hope. And I understand that when the children sang this opera, the older people in the audience were reduced to tears because the children were so hopeful and were looking ahead, and the music supported that, and that there were better days ahead, and so it's there in Brundibar. If we can hear any of that,
yeah. And then, how many of those kids made it out?
Well,
of
very few of them.
5,000 children who went through Terezin, about 100 survived. Mm.
Music from the children's opera Brundibar of Hans Krause, representing that sort of, it's beyond, far beyond ironic, that just incredible energy that can allow hope to happen in the face of this tragedy that went on in the throughout the Holocaust, throughout World War II, and certainly in the specific concentration camp of Terezin, from which Helen Lewis managed to escape, I guess is the wrong word, but she moved on from there to other horrors and then got out.
That's right. That's right. One thing that I haven't mentioned is the art which went on in Terezin as well. And we have some remarkable drawings of what went on, the day-to-day life there, and the horrors that all expressed through remarkable drawings by Bedrich Fritter, for example, Carol Fleischmann, Leo Haas. Apart from Leo Haas, all of those painters died in Auschwitz. But they give us a remarkable picture of life there, both the everyday life and the horrors that that happened there. And I will be showing a number of these drawings in the lecture as well. So while there was tremendous concentration on music, it wasn't only on music. There was the art. There were also, there was also debate, poetry readings, poetry competitions, and so on. So it was a very rich, full cultural life with each of the arts engaged in Terezin.
That Millercomb lecture by Sam McCready is at 4 o'clock today at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory Drive in Urbana, University of Illinois campus. And then at 7:30 tonight and tomorrow night, A Time to Speak, Sam McCready's adaptation from the Holocaust memoir by Helen Lewis, a solo performance by Joan McCready, with choreography by Philip Johnston and Kirsty Simpson, sound by Richard McCready, a relation, I'm guessing.
Awesome, yes.
So, and video Stephen Fisher and a lot of dancers involved in those projections of the choreography. There's no intermission, so don't be late. Performance lasts about 75 minutes, and I hope you've got an indication of just how powerful I suspect that really is going to be. Sam and Joe McCready, thanks very much for joining us on Live and Local.
Thank you for having us.
That was the those were the final moments from the second movement of Antonin Dvorak's B minor cello concerto with Jacqueline Dupre and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our portion of this program features three members of the Arcadia Chamber Players, who are giving their fall concert this Saturday evening at 7 o'clock at First Mennonite Church in Urbana, corner of Lincoln and Springfield, and as always, a program of music that chances are you haven't heard before. At least most of it you might have heard, I'm guessing, Gabriel Fauré's First Piano Quartet, or not. The Beethoven Serenade that's on their program is sufficiently not played that I could barely find any recordings that we had in our studio, but I did come up with one just in time, which we'll hear a little bit later on as we go out with the show, and then also some music by Bohuslav Martinu. The players who are with us on the show today, flutist Mary Leathers Chapman, clarinetist Marina Antoline, and pianist Deborah Suter. And Deborah is inaugurating it's not exactly a new piano, but it's new to us, courtesy of the University of Illinois School of Music, and we're very grateful to them. That we finally have a keyboard in this studio. It looks kind of cool. We'll see what it sounds like. Anyway, thank you all very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And especially Marina, in the middle of your teaching day.
Yes.
Remind folks, who are the Arcadia Chamber Players? Are you still the core, or do you now consider that you have an expanded core?
We have an expanded core. We have cellist Amy Flores. We have violist Jiyun Kim Schleicher. And we have actually two violinists right now. Maureen Murchie is playing with us for this concert and will be with us for the next concert also, along with Rachel Jacqueline, who is taking this concert off because she just had a baby.
Well, congratulations to her. Because you used to have just a core of you three, and that was the core, right?
Lots of guests.
Most of these people have guested with us on numerous occasions, and so we thought, well, how silly. Why don't we just invite them to be in our group?
And so you did.
Yeah, we did.
Well, and, you know, you always have these wonderful programs of music that you find in various places. I think we're going to sample a little bit of the Martinu in a little while, but tell us about the Beethoven Serenade.
The Beethoven Serenade is Opus 25 and originally written for flute, viola, flute, viola, and violin, but there was a transcription made of it by Franz Kleinhans a few years later, and it was Opus 41, and the transcription was for flute and piano. and he kept the flute part pretty much intact, and then put most of the viola and violin parts in the piano. And Beethoven heard it, he liked it, made just a few changes, and then it went to the publisher.
So which version are you guys doing then?
We're doing the one with strings, flute, violin, and viola.
Well, I would hope so.
Well, yes.
Because you've got them available.
That was the plan.
And this is this a piece you've played before, Mary?
I played it many, many years ago. I actually got a recording of it. Well, I still have it. It's on LP, and I've had that since probably the 70s, and always listened to it and liked it, and then got the music for the string parts and performed it many years ago, I think at the Tuesday Morning Musical Club. And
which is a group of, is it still all women?
It is.
Yes, it is.
And by we are requirement?
It is.
Yeah.
If you can imagine.
In Champaign-Urbana, yeah. Well, there have always been historically enough male groups that's fair enough. This is a pretty long work, if I remember. Or is that, there's another Serenade of Beethoven that I might be mixing it up
with. It's about 23 minutes, if you consider that long.
No, the other one I'm thinking of is close on to an hour.
Oh,
sort
really?
Of incredible.
Oh. No,
the other one goes on and on, if I say. So I'm sure this one doesn't. And what do you find particularly challenging about this piece, the Beethoven?
Probably technically. There's a lot of notes, as there always are in the flute parts.
Yeah, but you must be used to that.
Yes. No, I just, I love the melodies in the piece. I think that's why I wanted to do it again. It's just, I just think it's a very beautiful piece. And there's... some people say there are 6 movements. Some say there are 7 movements. The adagio that's right before the last movement is so short, and it ends on, I think it's a dominant 7th chord. And some think, well, it's so short and it doesn't really stand alone.
Maybe it's not really a movement.
It is more like an introduction.
Hmm.
So take your pick.
So I gather this is a piece that you suggested to the group, too.
Yes,
let's
I
play
did.
This,
mm-hmm.
Which and it represents the democratic way in which programming happens with the Acadia Chamber Players.
Right.
Is that a fair enough term?
Oh, yes. Sure. Yes, we have a meeting at the beginning of each season, actually in August, way before, sometimes in July or June. And we discuss, you know, what we'd like to play, and we always ask everyone's opinion. And everybody's been really accommodating on, you know, agreeing to play things that we love or, you know, that we have certain relationships with. So everybody gets a voice.
How do you decide what goes with what? In other words, what, you know, what belongs on what program together? Do you think about that?
Well, we have to think about the timings,
yeah.
For one, and we want everybody to have a chance to play.
So, and we want a variety of styles
variety.
In each program.
Yeah. We don't want all classical or, you know, we try to make a variety.
Well, when you say classical, you mean like
Mozart-type
people.
Yes. Yes.
Mozart-type people. Yeah.
In the classical music period.
You do play classical music.
Yes.
You know, in
as
the
a
broader
genre.
Sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exclusively. Have you ventured beyond the classical, meaning, you know, I don't know, anything jazzier or you're classical musicians primarily, so that's what you did.
Yep. We played Uncorked, Krannert Uncorked one time a number of years ago, and we did more sort of lighter, we did a couple of jazzy tunes and popular songs. Not necessarily popular that the general public would recognize, but popular in that it's lighter and, you know, more tuneful and not as technical.
So for Krannert Uncorked, it was Arcadia Unplugged.
That's right. Yes,
so to speak.
Yes, and it's quite difficult. Actually, they typically, I think, do, you know, plugged-in instruments, and so it was hard to get the piano and the lighting and things worked out for us. So,
yeah, they're used to, in the lobby anyway, they
mm-hmm.
do all that. I really would love to protest to the Krannert people who are, for some of these lobby things, they're just so loud.
Are they loud?
And I can't comprehend why that's necessary. So I'm saying this over the airwaves. If any of you Krannert folks have anything to do with that, I mean, you walk out of a Chicago Symphony concert, I think it was Chicago or Pacifica Quartet, one of those recently that I went to, and, you know, you've just heard this sublime music of Shostakovich or whoever the was going on in the Great Hall, and, you know, the music in the lobby might be swell, but if it's so loud you can't enjoy it, it's like this mad crash on your ears and, you know, I'm on a campaign, worldwide campaign, to eradicate this absurdly loud music that nobody needs to hear that way. And I would be willing to bet that most people, if you really ask them, would just assume that it weren't that way. But somebody's decided things have to be loud. Anyway, it's not going to be that kind of concert Saturday night with your Acadia Chamber Players. I'm off my soapbox. tell us about the music we're about to hear live, Bohuslav Martinu.
Oh, boy. Well, everybody has heard the story that Martinu lived in a bell tower till he was 12.
I'll bet you not everybody has heard that story, so why don't you tell it?
Well, apparently
or was that the story?
Yes, he and his family were the bell keepers in his little Czechoslovakian town. And so he lived there until he was 12, and fairly isolated from the rest of the town. You know, he looked down upon people functioning and doing their thing. And so I guess that affected him for the rest of his life. He was pretty much a loner, and he liked to read, and he liked to compose music. And so he read the works of Einstein and Eastern and Western philosophers, and that also influenced his composition.
Did he have a chronic case of vertigo, I wonder?
It didn't mention that in what I read. But.
And how do you think that shows up in his music?
Well, I'm not sure, other than his music is very contrapuntal and very rhythmically diverse, and all, you know, on the offbeats and kind of hemiola feeling, and everything's kind of offset. And so I don't know if that somehow comes from being isolated in that bell tower.
Well, a lot of his music has a nice sense of humor.
It does.
In a sometimes sort of angular way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know this piece we're going to play. So,
well, it's very interesting. It's very well known in the clarinet world. Mm. It's just part of our standard repertoire. We study it in college, and that's what we do. But apparently it's not known outside the clarinet world hardly at all. So I'm glad to be able to introduce. I like this piece. It's a lovely little piece. It's interesting in that it has no form. He flew in the face of the structure of music, and he kind of, I think he did that on purpose. And so it's a lot of little sections just kind of strung together. And they have relationship to each other in that they are rhythmically interesting, and they have beautiful melodies. But there's only one thing in the piece that suggests a form, and that is the opening statement, 60, 70 bars, is also repeated in verbatim exactly about halfway through the piece. So just very interesting. I mean, but I think it's joyful and it's interesting. And it's, I say it's a little lighter, but Deb and I have worked really hard on this piece of music to put it together. Martinu is very intricate in his rhythms.
Well, sometimes the lightest music requires the hardest work to make sure it sounds that way.
Yes.
Which portion of it or portions are we going to hear?
Well, we had a hard time kind of deciding because it's cut up into so many different little things. We thought that the second statement, the second opening statement that he reiterates, is a place that we're going to start, and we're just going to play just a few sections.
Okay. It's from the Sonatina for Clarinet and Piano by Bohuslav Martinu, with Marina Antoline on the clarinet, Deborah Suter on the piano, both members of the Arcadia Chamber Players, who are giving their fall concert Saturday night at 7 o'clock in Urbana.
Thank you.
So is that the end of a section, or is that's not the end of the piece? And it just kind of moves on from there.
Moves into the slow section, the Andante.
Oh, which we're not going to hear anything of.
Aww. You have to come to the concert to hear the rest.
That sounds like fun. It's a nice teaser. And then you've got the Fauré First Piano Quartet. How many piano quartets did you do?
Two.
Quartets. There's two of them?
Two piano quartets and two piano quintets.
And is there such a thing as a best known of those four pieces?
Yes, this one is.
It's considered
one of his very best chamber works. In fact, Copland said it's pure loveliness and said it was one of his most delightful compositions.
And I'm guessing that since the Serenade of Beethoven for flute, violin, and viola was a Mary's choice, and the Martinu we just sampled was Marina's choice, that the Fauré was Deb's choice?
Well, we wanted to do a piano quartet, so the string players and I looked at a few piano quartets and decided on this one.
And why this one? And what were the other ones you thought about, if you remember?
Yeah, I'm not sure I do remember, actually. We had several from the library there. This one is quite well known. Some of them had done it before and really loved it. We didn't want a classic piece at this point. We wanted something in the Romantic period. And it's a very unique French piece, so it's a lot of fun. It's really a beautiful piece.
Well, why don't we hear, since we talked about it earlier, we should have played it at the time, I guess, a little bit of the Beethoven Serenade, flute, violin, piano, violin, viola. And this is a recording, I think, with members of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center on Live and Local. Thank you. Well, two apologies in order there. One is that that wasn't the piece I said it was going to be. I failed to let our recording engineer know what we were going to be doing here. So that was actually music by Robert Schumann from the last concert by the Arcadia Chamber Players. So you heard the players themselves, Deborah Suter. And who was involved in that performance?
That was Rachel Jacklin on violin, Ji-Yoon Kim Schleicher on viola, and Amy Flores on cello.
On the cellist, and Schumann Piano Quartet.
Quartet.
And we will hear the Beethoven, fragment of the Beethoven Serenade in just a couple of minutes. The other apology is we're having a little trouble with, Mike Pritchard says, gremlins in our soundboard. And I'm not sure how much of that got to you as our listener with some cutting out of one channel or another, but I apologize for that. And the Arcadia Chamber Players are giving their fall concert Saturday night at 7 o'clock at the First Mennonite Church at Lincoln and Springfield in Urbana.
And there's parking behind the church.
Yeah. And you got a pair of tickets to give away.
Yes. The first person that calls 384-0568 can have two free tickets.
And just leave a message on that phone at 384-0568. Just a quick look at a few other events going on in our area. There's a Millikan University composition recital tonight at 7:30 at Kuiper Hall on the Millikan campus in Decatur. The Salvatore Martorano Composition Award concert is tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. University of Illinois Opera Ensemble class recital is tomorrow night at 7:30. Always some interesting things going on there. Eastern Illinois University Percussion Ensemble is at Dvorak Concert Hall in the Down of Fine Arts Center tomorrow night in Charleston, 7:30. And it's the Prairie Ensemble Benefit Concert, A Taste at Tiernan's Hall in Urbana at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. That's 7 o'clock tonight. You know, I wasn't here yesterday, and I've got my dates mixed up. The Millikan Composition Recital was yesterday. The Salvatore Martorano Composition Concert is tonight at 7:30. The Opera Ensemble is tonight at 7:30. The Percussion Ensemble tonight at 7:30. And the Prairie Ensemble is tonight at 7 o'clock. Thank you all very much for joining us on the show. And best of luck with the concert.
Thank you.
Support for our show today comes in part from Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from noon to 4 in the Bouvance Tasting Room. More information is at thecorkscrew.com. This is Illinois Public Media, WYNL FM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. Here's a tiniest fragment of Beethoven's Serenade.